Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
You might have seen in this morning's paper that deportation orders are heading for their highest point in 4 years. That's a story published in today's Irish Times, with nearly 1,100 asylum seekers served with notice to leave the country in the first 6 months of the year. That is more than the entire number of deportation orders issued in 2023. But most deportations in Ireland are voluntary, and it remains unclear how many of those served with orders have actually left the country. To analyse what's going on behind these figures, I'm joined by Stephen Kerwin, Head of Immigration at KOD Lyons Law. Good morning to you, Stephen.
Morning, Philip. How are you?
1,100 asylum seekers served with orders does not translate, does it, to 1,100 people being escorted onto flights?
No, and I think it's important that your listeners are aware that, and I believe not just coming from from the legal profession, but also from the department themselves, who are having to deal with the logistical nightmare of enforcing deportation orders. They are extremely complex and expensive. In order to get someone removed from the state, there is detection work that can be required, there's detentions and custodies, there's trying to agree returns with the returning nation, the obtaining of travel documents, the cost of flights, other travel arrangements. And then that's notwithstanding the fact that we already are under significant pressure in terms of resourcing and having a massive backlog of deportation order appointments, for example, dating back to kind of pre-COVID times. So it is a very, very complex situation. Certainly the rise in numbers is evident, but we're still coming from a very low base, and it is just important to bear that in mind, it's that situation.
Well, can we burrow into that in a little bit more detail, please? The first thing that you said there, detection, actually finding the people upon whom deportation orders have been served. In your experience, how complicated is that? How many people typically can it take?
Oh, it's incredibly difficult. And again, what normally happens is that once someone is issued with a deportation order, they are given directions to report to GNIB, to the Garda National Immigration Bureau, for reporting, and they're supposed to give an address at which they stay at. Now, again, if someone goes underground, how does that even work? How is someone detected? How is someone found? Again, people don't have the right to work. They can be incredibly vulnerable, scared in some cases. And there are stories, and certainly with the last regularisation scheme, which occurred under Miss Justice Helen McEntee, when she had introduced the amnesty. I mean, I think they had given amnesty to over 3,000 people, and they're people who, I mean, would have presented, had stayed kind of in the system for a number of years and were kind of left in the ether, not being able to kind of afford to leave. And again, that just goes to prove how hard detection was. That these were people that, I mean, it was double the numbers that I think they had even expected to be able to avail of the scheme.
And Stephen, in your experience, how often would trying to detect one of these people who has gone underground prove to be a bit of a wild goose chase because they've actually left the jurisdiction?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is another point that, the presentation of statistics in terms of the enforceability of some of these orders, that's another problem. If someone gets up and leaves and doesn't notify the minister, it can often be years later that, you know, for example, someone might voluntarily leave and then seek to come back to the state at some point in the future, at which point they're notified of the fact that they have an existing order that they didn't even realise they had, because they had already voluntarily left the state without informing people. So, I mean, even those checks, kind of even at the external borders, it's very, very unclear, other than carrying out massive doorstep operations, often looking at using the Workplace Relations Commission and their jurisdiction to be able to investigate kind of working practices or people working without appropriate permission. They're kind of the more common way, certainly, that we would see in this office that people would be located.
Assuming then that you do find somebody and you take them into custody, I presume there is a massive coordination and logistical job to be done in getting sufficient numbers of people to make it worth your while to charter a flight to, for argument's sake, Kenya or Rwanda or wherever.
Absolutely. And again, there's a dual challenge there. Number one, obtaining the appropriate travel documents to facilitate the exit from the state, but also dealing with other member states, other countries in terms of taking individuals back and failed asylum seekers back.
Because you can't just leave them on the runway. There has to be some kind of a reception at the other end.
Well, there has to be coordination at a diplomatic level, exactly. And not only does that cost money, not only does that take time, there's also a question as to the unresponsiveness of other states. So, that is a real issue.
Michael McDougall wrote recently of his time in the Department of Justice, and I'm quoting directly now, "We attempted deportation flights with minimal impact 20 years ago when I was minister. They are costly, ineffective and liable to last-minute injunctions." Do you think that there's any reason that deportation flights would operate any more successfully now?
Well, it's very rare that I would agree with Senator McDougall on absolutely anything. But certainly in relation to his comments there, he is correct. The system is incredibly inefficient. What I would also say, there are reasons for those challenges, and certainly spurious challenges are absolutely not entertained by the court, and he would absolutely know that. People have a right to challenge these decisions that are made against them for various reasons. These decisions can be overturned. Do I think they work any better now? Without cooperation from various member states and non-EU member states as well, at that level of coordination, it is incredibly difficult and incredibly costly. And what I suppose advocates like myself or people that work with international protection applicants would always argue, whether they're successful or otherwise, is that there has to be a cost analysis as well of any of these proposed measures, and we have to look at that in the round. And also bearing in mind that often people in the international protection system are economically active and have been here for many, many years contributing to the economy, and there does have to be a cost-benefit analysis there as well, kind of, when we're looking at these issues.
How well is the fast-track system working in your view, Kevin?
Yeah, I think we...
Stephen, excuse me, I beg your pardon.
No, you're fine. We now have a what we are seeing emerging is a dual track system, basically. We have accelerated procedures from those who are deemed to be from safe countries, and then we have, I suppose, the more standard or routine international protection applications. We are not seeing any dent kind of being made in any practical way in those kind of normal, if you want to call it that way, or non-safe country designated cases. Whereas on the other hand, we're seeing individuals from safe countries of origin, so designated, being fast-tracked through the system without oral hearings, with a mess of an administrative system that's there. And again, which are more likely to be subject to court challenges, to be perfectly frank about it, given the fact that they've been carried out in such a haphazard way without any regard to due process. So while we're seeing improvements in some ways, because everyone is looking, and any advocacy group is telling you that we don't want more efficient or kind of fast-tracked applications, is probably not being fully true. Everyone is advocating for that, but what we are now seeing is a dual system here, where you have
a two-speed system rather than a two-tier system.
Sorry, not only a two-speed, but also the justice between those two tracks is absolutely varying. And certainly we're going from a situation where there are some people who are waiting far, far, far too long. And on the other hand, we have a system where people are being rushed out the door without being heard properly or actually being considered. So in some ways, it is a two-tier system.
So do you have fears then that when you see countries like Algeria and Botswana being added to the safe countries list quite recently, do you have fears that... there may be people with genuine asylum cases who just aren't getting the chance to be heard properly just because these countries have been designated safe?
Absolutely. And again, that's what this goes back to. Early and effective advice being given to individuals in relation to the various options that they have, and putting a proper, fair procedure in place. And that does include, in cases, having an oral hearing in relation to cases. I think that is a far more efficient way to deal with it. I understand it is a complex issue. It is a very difficult issue to deal with, but I would be very concerned how the designation of countries as a safe country of origin is impacting on the right to actually have fair procedures in relation to cases.
Does it damage the integrity of international protection and the asylum process that we continue to effectively deal with economic migrants through the asylum process rather than creating two proper and distinct ways to enter the country?
I couldn't agree more, and I think that is an issue. I also think that international protection and kind of economic migrant movements and patterns, I think they're not necessarily separate ideas. Sometimes people are fleeing situations of persecution or situations of extreme hardship or poverty, right, which may not necessarily fall within the definition of international protection, but overlaps with the question of economic markets. And I don't think they're necessarily two separate strands. They can be in some cases, absolutely, for sure. But the line between who is an international protection applicant and who is an economic migrant is not as often as easy as is portrayed sometimes. I think it is quite a complex question.
No, it is complex, but it also doesn't. It drags the entire system into disrepute in the eyes of those people with a grievance in this country. When people who have come here to do as human beings have done over millennia, we have just moved, that is the history of the human species. But when those people come here and do so through the asylum system and then end up being looked after by the state in the way that no economic migrant would have a legitimate expectation of.
Absolutely. And I think one of the issues with the employment permit system that we have, we've seen great strides being made recently to try and modernise it, to try and rationalise it and make it better. But I wonder, is it too restrictive? Is it operating in a fair way? I would certainly have questions in relation to that. And I would agree the lack of other pathways or viable pathways for individuals is not helpful. On the other hand, you might hear the argument to say, well, it's not Ireland's problem. And that's why we have a system that's there. But it does, as you say, because we don't have other viable options, then you have those cases which are stuck in the middle, those humanitarian cases. And in theory, the system is meant to be able to cater to those cases where you fall below the standard of someone who should be declared a refugee. We have things like permission to remain, for example, on humanitarian grounds. But again, I worry with the level at which we're rushing these applications through, is that really being examined? And again, that's not to take a pot shot at anyone who's dealing with these cases in terms of the department, but it is a question that I would have. And is it in the best economic interest of the country to be deporting people en masse in circumstances where, you know, they have contributed to the economy, you know, and most of them do perform a vital role, not only societally, but also economically.
Stephen Kerwin, partner at Head of Immigration at KOD Lyons Law. Thank you very much. Coming up after the break, was it a chat? Was it an interview? Was it a love-in when Elon met Donald?
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.